Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Here we go again. One of those Soros-funded prosecutors, or for perhaps a series of them, whether they're Soros-funded or not, those decarceration, non-prosecution prosecutors. The murder of two police officers in L.A. at a hotel the other day on Tuesday.
Horrible, yes.
The suspect who gunned down two cops at a motel 20 minutes outside of L.A. was on probation for illegally carrying a gun and had been banned from packing heat since 2011. Somebody want to pass a law? The suspect had served two prison terms for burglary and car theft, pleaded no contest to possessing a firearm as a felon just last winter. The weapons charge could have sent the career criminal back to prison for 3 years, but instead he was sentenced to 2 years probation and 20 days of time served. So had he been sentenced to the max under the law, which is what the gun lobby would support, NRA members like me, he wouldn't have been on the streets. Those two police officers would be alive. Or they certainly wouldn't have died at the hands of this individual in that moment on Tuesday. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Even, you know, I mean, as you're thinking about this electorally, which is where the response needs to happen, and by the way, it's happening in L.A.
Oh, yeah. They're getting the signatures they need. They have 566,857 signatures collected as of Tuesday.
They got them, so recall of Gasson, the L.A. County State's Attorney, is going to be on the ballot. And this after, of course, Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers' prodigy, Chesa Boudin, was recalled just a couple of weeks ago, last week.
That's progress.
And remember, we talked about Gasson recently in the last few days. This is a guy who was just rebuked by California courts because he didn't want to enforce the state's three strikes and you're out law. Now, I'm not saying that this guy who's charged or would have been charged had he not been shot and killed in a police shootout after he killed those two police officers. I'm not saying that this guy was a candidate for three strikes and you're out, life imprisonment. But just, again, two-time...
He shouldn't have been
two prison terms for burglary and car theft. No contest to possessing a firearm. Get guns off the streets. You got to get cracked down on people who commit crimes with guns. Yeah, I know. Right. I agree. And
this guy. And what did they do?
And when you do, you get he gets probation instead of a 3 year prison sentence.
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Yeah, the thing about the law and order issue is even if you're away from the fray, even if the likelihood that you would be a victim of a violent crime is de minimis, and it is generally, unless you're in particular neighborhoods, it highlights something. And what it highlights to me is that the people in charge who have the primary responsibility for providing for peace on the streets do not care about peace on the streets. And it's, in addition to it being dangerous and it costing lives, like the lives of those two officers in L.A., it's insulting. And it's an abrogation of your duty. and you lied to me. I mean, how many layers of offense does it take to rise up? Well, we're finding out. By the way, let's remember Gaston in L.A., the attorney there, prosecutor there, non-prosecutor. I mean, this is how far the Black Lives Matter new Marxists pushed L.A. and the country. Gaston defeated a black female Democrat incumbent L.A. Prosecutor named Jackie Lacey in the primary because she wasn't enough of a non-prosecution decarceration prosecutor. So, you know, now you're not enjoying the consequences of the ideological disposition you brought to the table, your identitarianism, and you're pulling the plug on these guys. Well, at least they're pulling the plug. What are we doing in Chicago? Well, we'll see. We have the chance to pull the plug on a tiny mayor come February and potentially April of next year. I mean, really, if we were serious about holding public officials to account in Chicago, Triple Threat wouldn't make it out of the primary. I don't care how many candidates there are. She would, the majority of Chicago, supermajority of Chicago, would say, you have disqualified yourself from re-election. There'll be two other candidates in the runoff. We'll see. Could happen. Something else going on in L.A. And again, we think restorative justice, alternative sentencing, no prosecution for retail theft under $1,000, and so on and so forth. Let them run wild as they ply their trade to become career criminals. Wall Street Journal reporting on this, another California shoplifting victim. Manny Huzar is remembered as a big-hearted guy by customers and coworkers at the Safeway in San Jose, where he worked. Last week, the 24-year-old was shot and killed by a thief in the liquor aisle. Decriminalized shoplifting. Prop 47 in California. Again, so here we go. California, this referendum crazy state. Prop 47, decriminalizing shoplifting, which Kim Fox and the power structure in Chicago have done by fiat. His coworkers at Safeway tell the San Jose Mercury News that shoplifters would often brazenly walk out with carts of liquor. Managers told workers not to accost shoplifters, but one said he and Mr. Huzar would sometimes tell suspicious characters in the liquor aisle after 2 a.m. that it was too late for liquor sales in the hopes of deterring them. Manny Huzar's killer hasn't been caught, and the retailers in the state warn that such deadly encounters could become more common as criminals have become emboldened. Prop 47 made stealing up to $950 in property a misdemeanor. Soros, Newsom, Gaston, Bodine, socially conscious business executives backed the initiatives. They argued the change would save the state and localities money on jailing supposedly low-level offenders, such as drug users. But it's costing businesses a fortune. Thieves now go from store to store, swiping shelves clean of merchandise. A common related search on Google these days for shoplifting in California is, how much can you steal in California without getting in trouble?
Well, that's why so many CVSs and Walgreens have closed, because we've seen the videos of people going in with garbage bags and then coming out with the garbage bags full of stuff.
Yeah.
And no one's stopping them. And it happens here in Chicago, too. I had a friend who saw it. She said, you talk about it, you see it is one thing, but when it's right in front of you, it is just alarming. The boldness of these people that just walk in and literally clear a whole cosmetic counter, just take everything they want and then walk out the door, and nobody stops them.
You had that D-bag actor Michael Rapaport in New York film a guy cleaning the shelves in a drugstore in his neighborhood in New York, and he was aghast. Well, yeah, I'm aghast at the implications of the policies I support. So California voters, I should say. L.A. Times Berkeley Institute for Governmental Studies survey in February found that by a 2-to-1 margin, California voters favor rolling back Prop 47's limits on felony prosecutions for property crimes. Yeah. Don't like seeing the cities ravaged. We're going to lead with our sentiment. Oh, second chances and low-level offenses and alternative sentencing and, you know, and let's look at the identitarian composition of the suspect before we decide whether prosecution and sentencing and what level of sentencing is appropriate rather than the behavior.
And instead they're wasting their time going after gun legislation when they should just be enforcing the laws that are on the books or changing the laws so that you can get, like, that guy should have never have been out of prison.
Yeah,
who shot those two officers.
By the way, I mean, just as a leading indicator, the guy had a tattoo over his left eyebrow.
That said what?
Somebody's name.
Oh, please.
You know, leading indicator. I mean, I just as a rule, I'm so hardline on this. I think a facial tattoo should be a felony. And you should, that's mandatory jail. But now, leading indicator, I mean, again, so hasn't been able, the guy who killed the cops, hasn't been able to legally own a gun since 2011, and yet here we are as of Tuesday. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
560. The Answer.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and Daniel Schmidt is one of those kids at the University of Chicago. He's part of that Chicago Thinker group.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Newspaper that went after Egghead, Brian Stelter from CNN, and ghastly person from The Atlantic when David Axelrod's Institute of Political Skullduggery had all those big media types come in. And
well, they're just not afraid to ask the hard questions.
Educate the kids about how things work in the real world. Yeah, they just ask questions,
well,
and they made Stelter look like a goof.
Yeah, and they think that you go to University of Chicago, you're going to just go along with whatever Axelrod says or with whatever Stelter says.
Well, you can understand why they believe that, because it's largely true. And what Daniel Schmidt also observed after completing his freshman year at University of Chicago is that you have a better chance of finding a unicorn on the campus of University of Chicago than a straight, middle-income, conservative white kid. Here's Daniel Schmidt on with Jesse Waters.
I think the only reason I got in as a white male is because I am very low income. I have not met a single middle-class white kid at my school, and I met middle-class people of other races, so I can't imagine it's the price tag. I think there is a deliberate agenda from the top to ban middle-class white people because they see them as threats. They see them as most likely to be conservative, most likely to support Trump, and they don't want people who are going to threaten the system to get into these elite universities. They want obedient, corporate, and political slaves.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. They want obedient, corporate, and political slaves. Mm-hmm. Five observations Daniel Schmidt offered after his freshman year at the $80,000 a year, University of Chicago. Staggeringly high number of LGBTQIA+. I'm talking 20 to 30%. Don't believe me? At Yale, 23% of freshmen identify as LGBTQ+.
I'm not buying that number. Because you have to write these essays to get into these schools. And if you write and say or claim that you're gay or lesbian or transgender, you have a much better chance of getting in. That's what I heard from people in the know.
23% of freshmen identify as LGBTQ plus. Identify as. How are you to know? Are you going to have them perform an act?
Exactly.
The point is, so what does that say about the culture on campus? What does that say about admissions if that's a leg up? That's the point. I have no reason to believe it's any different at other elite universities. So why are so many high-performing students LGBTQ+? Nationally, only around 7% of adults are LGBTQ+. And that's even arguably inflated other than the social contagion piece of it. Observation number two. His fellow students, scarily obedient to even the most illogical demands, as you just heard him say on Waters' program. As an anecdote, the administration had just ended the mask mandate for students. The next day, one of my professors exclaimed that everyone should still be wearing masks because we're still in a pandemic. Without hesitation, every single student around me who all came into class not wearing a mask automatically put a mask on their face. The whole scene felt incredibly creepy and robotic. I ended up being the only student in the room who wasn't wearing a mask. Keep in mind, these are kids who scored perfect scores on the SAT, won math Olympiad competitions, and likely have IQs way above average, and yet they quietly obey demands that any sane person would laugh at. Whatever happened to the youth being rebellious? Why is it that kids at state schools who likely had imperfect test scores and grades in high school appear much freer and like real human beings? Well, because you're playing the game, don't you know? What does he start his thread with? I mean, he answers his own question. This is a state that's going to a school, I should say, University of Chicago, that produces political leaders and billionaires. Well, I've got to play the game. Got to play the game. I'm not here to be an independent thinker. I'm here for the payoff. I want to be part of the ruling class. Third observation, as you heard him offer, I have not met a single middle-class white kid. Not a single middle-class white kid. By white, I mean of European ancestry. Every white kid I know is either low-income like myself or extremely wealthy. Every time I do meet a white kid who appears to be middle-class, I shortly learn they are actually Hispanic and marked Hispanic on their college application, giving them significant help. It seems it's a virtual impossible. It's virtually impossible to get into an elite university as a middle-class white kid unless the kid has an extremely prodigal ability. The standards for all other economic classes are way lower. Does that sound right to you about if you're a middle-income family? Because it sounds right to me, and I say it sounds right to me going back to when I was applying for schools as a middle-income honky.
From the mean streets of Wheaton.
The middle-income family, and this has long been the case, it's even more so now that they've fallen out of identitarian favor, and that doesn't is not limited to white kids, but it's most pronounced. They get squeezed from both sides, and they pay retail for everything. And all the scholarship programs and the income thresholds for it. I mean, you're just standard issue middle income white kid from suburbia. Boring. No place for you. You're not interesting.
Apologize for your whiteness, too.
The record, the assessment of the upside. Who cares? A fourth observation from Daniel Schmidt. Most self-described conservative students are spineless and hardly even conservative. They would never dare speak honestly about January 6th or criticize mass immigration or be vocally opposed to anti-white sentiment. They would rather write about trite political philosophy to appear smart and look good on a resume for Yale Law School than use the unique and powerful opportunities an elite university gives them to challenge the regime. Oh, that's also an observation I could have made 25 years ago at Northwestern. It's been going on at least that long. So Daniel Schmidt is just recording what has been afoot for a long time, understanding how we got to this place. Didn't happen overnight. Lastly, last observation from Schmidt after his freshman year at U of C. Most students will happily become slaves to wokeism if it means getting a top job at a prestigious financial institution. Companies like Goldman and McKinsey realize this and prey on these students, knowing they can use them as corporate and political slaves. Reciting their pronouns every time they introduce themselves, check. Mm. Supporting blatantly anti-white racial equity training, check. Virtue signaling on LinkedIn so an HR employee at Bain Capital can hopefully notice, check. These kids seem genuinely empty inside. Tom in Oswego, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
And Amy, hopefully some people aren't listening to my phone call. It may affect my children's either employment, current or looking. I've got it. My youngest son's fiance is looking for a professional position. She's very talented, but again, middle-class white person. It just cannot even seem to get an offer. My youngest son is in HR, and he tells me the horrifying stories of people trying to apply for the positions. They come right out of college demanding more than $45,000, $55,000 a year. They don't want the job. My oldest son, who's applying for a public service job, and I won't say what that is, he has been applying everywhere, highly qualified. But we get the feeling that because he's, you know, a white, middle-aged, my wife and I are well off, that he's just not getting a look. And I'm really afraid this is starting to trickle, not just in the education, but employment. And it's really sad because good, qualified people are getting hurt with this.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, Tom. Well, right. I mean, that's the point that Daniel Schmidt makes, and we've made many times on the show, goes in both directions. As you, one of his observations, you know, they're going to play the game because they want to get a look from Bain Capital or Goldman or Morgan Stanley or whoever. And so what you have is previous generation elite university grads at these institutions that are pressing their new Marxism within these institutions and signaling back to the elite universities, this is how you get to where I am. It's not complicated. Bill in Monticello, Indiana.
Yeah, good morning, guys. When I started my undergraduate career at Purdue, Johnson was president, the Vietnam War was raging, and the bumper sticker said, question authority. Mm-hmm. What the hell happened to my generation, and what the heck happened to kids today?
Mm-hmm. They feel entitled. I don't know what it is.
Thanks, Bill.
They grew up in the I'm a victim culture. I can't figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I can't pinpoint it. I think it's a bunch of different things, but I don't know. It's just, we got to raise men to be good characters, to have good character, I should say, and be strong, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
They've been trained to be their own god and genuflect at the solipsist church, which is the state. Be a good, dutiful sentinel of the sort of corporate industrial complex, if you will. And so they are. They're Marxists. You say, well, wait a second. They want to go work at Bain Capital. They want to work at Goldman. They want to get into law school so they can go on to work at a white shoe law firm. Right. They're materialists. That's Marxism. So many people don't understand that, no matter how many times I explain it. They're Marxists. A lot of them don't even know it. They've been trained to be, as it's so interesting, Schmidt said, they seem like they are empty inside. They are. They are soulless tools of materialist interests. Maybe people need to brush up on Marx. The modern iteration just has a racial and gender overlay. It's fundamentally the same thing that's been pushed by totalitarian states for the last 130 years. They're Marxists. Don't let their net worth or their family's net worth fool you. Corey in Woodlawn.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I don't doubt that the conservative kids that go to the University of Chicago have a problem expressing their conservatism. Liberals are the ones that have a problem with bleeding into Woodlawn and bringing their ideas. There's one gentleman, I won't even say his name, constantly agitating for housing policies that don't help African-Americans, don't help us build equity wealth, just basically build more and more low-income housing in a neighborhood that's completely saturated with it. But these kids that come from the University of Chicago with their liberal ideas just bleeding into the neighborhood to try this that has already been tried before.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Corey. Well, they're going to save you from yourself.
And nobody questions authority. They just go along to get all. You wear a mask? Okay. How tight? Want me to wear two? Okay.
Nobody questions.
Fight back.
Nobody questions results either.
I know.
To Corey and Woodlawn's point, I mean, the disastrous consequences of public housing policy in Chicago over the last 70 years. Disastrous.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep doing it. Greg in LaGrange.
Hi, good morning. I think it's, if you went back and looked at the recent tablet article about the Pritzker rule and how they want to change the universal concept of dimorphic sex into something along the lines of the spectrum of colors that we have, and you look at what the federal government is doing in terms of giving aid to food programs to schools, unless they toe a line where boys can shower with girls. And if you look at the federal government and how they're going to give money to charitable organizations that give out food to those disadvantaged and aid to those disadvantaged, being tied to the same concept that you have to allow men to shower with women, you can only see this going one way. And it's been going this way for a long time, and it is a complete destruction of the middle class. And maybe it's not Marxism, maybe it's Leninism. Useful idiots. This is what happens when you take an education system and you completely pervert it and teach the concepts of Marxist Leninism, and this is what the end result is.
Thanks, Greg. Sorry to interrupt, Greg. Thanks. I want to get this in, too. Tiverton High School in Devon, England, banning skirts as part of their uniform policy. Okay. Want to, you know, make it more gender neutral for the women. I assume skirts worn by the men would be fine. But no more skirts, trousers only uniform policy. So look for that coming to your Catholic and ornamentation only schools in the suburbs, the Loyola Academies, the Bennett Academies, all of the Catholic schools that have dispensed with the catechism, dispensed with the notions of how kids should be educated, how kids should be disciplined. And embraced, essentially, the nihilism of the new Marxists, haven't they? And we've talked about uniform policy and CPS before as a way to institute sort of a culture of discipline,
mm-hmm.
like a corporate culture within these schools.
Well, they said they didn't want to be distracted. If somebody wore, you know, a flashy T-shirt, that might take them off their studies. That's what I heard. Because we had uniforms for a while, and then we voted against them.
Yeah. That was a mistake, and it continues to be a mistake. But now, you know, women need to look less like women, more androgynous, just like the men. I mean, this really is sort of sci-fi stuff going on here. And, yeah, if you read that tablet article that Greg and LaGrange referenced about the Pritzkers, particularly Colonel Jennifer, as he calls himself now, Pritzker. There's a lot more sci-fi stuff coming if we let it. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You know, your betters in government do not like it when you do not play along. We saw that with the Brexit revolt. We saw that with Trump's election in 2016. We see that going on right now with the Jan 6 Star Chamber and all of those Republicans quietly cheering on Quislings like Cheney and Kinzinger, even the new Marxists like Schiff, because they don't want to see Trump back in 24. And I'm not, you know, declaring my allegiance to Trump by any stretch of the imagination, or that I'd prefer him in 24 over DeSantis. But I don't appreciate the conniving nature of the combine Republican, and that is not limited anymore to Illinois. Actually, it never was. It also includes those combine Republicans in D.C., inside the Beltway, those Republicans that are transactional, the consultant class that just wants to line their money with the pockets of billionaires they have access to, and wants to make sure, in the immortal words of Bill Cellini, as memorialized by John Cass, that the way it works is when we're in, we're in. Mm-hmm. And when they're in, we're in. We're always in. That's Karl Rove, for example. Karl Rove writing in the Wall Street Journal: fringe GOP candidates struggling in primaries are getting temporary aid from unusual allies. Democrats are spending tens of millions of dollars on ads in Republican primaries depicting the more radical contender as too conservative, which may be an effective attack in a general election, but appeals to Republican voters in primaries. The upside for Democrats is it can lead the GOP to nominate candidates who are less attractive to swing voters in November. They're using this strategy to meddle in the June 28 primaries for governor of Illinois and U.S. senator and governor in Colorado. So let's focus on Illinois, since that's where we are. 12 days away. Here's Karl Rove's handle from afar. Aurora, Illinois Mayor Richard Irvin, a conservative veteran. And former prosecutor who emphasizes fighting crime, cutting taxes and spending and cleaning up politics, and who happens to be black, would be a strong contender this November. That's why Governor Pritzker and the DGA are spending an estimated $32 million, nothing close to that, by the way, labeling Mr. Irvin's principal primary opponent, Senator Darren Bailey, as too conservative for Illinois. Mr. Bailey is a freshman legislator from a downstate district of farms and forests along the Indiana border, without major cities or media coverage. The GOP's best chance to win statewide is a nominee who renews the party's strength in the northern suburbs while still attracting support from downstate Republican strongholds. and then gets more votes in Chicago than GOP candidates normally do. To deny Mr. Irvin the nomination, Democrats are spending far more depicting Mr. Bailey as a strong conservative than Mr. Bailey is spending on his own campaign. Also not true. But how about the characterization? Darren Bailey is from southern Illinois, where there's no people. There's just farms and forests. He's a fringe candidate. That's the title of the piece. Why are Democrats funding the GOP fringe? I'd like somebody to distinguish the policy positions of a Gary Rabine from a Darren Bailey. Because I would have difficulty doing so, and I follow this stuff fairly closely. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 646-36-DA, turnkey.protextline. Darren Bailey is a fringe candidate because he's got a southern accent in Illinois. That seems to be the sum total of it. Oh, and because he believes in God. I mean, and he's, you know, not unwilling to say it. That makes him fringe. The Republican primary voters are being hoodwinked by the DGA and by Governor Jellybelly. Is that right? Because the smart play is to watch what Governor Pritzker is doing and agree with him. That's the smart play. The smart play is to say, I've decided that your best chance is this guy, so Republicans, you should also believe that. Because we should take, as I said the other day when we were talking about this, we should take J.B. Pritzker's deep insights into the human condition and Republican Party politics to heart. We should let him determine who our nominee is by whatever he expresses as who our nominee shouldn't be. Really? You know, it's interesting what Rove doesn't mention, in addition to getting all sorts of things wrong, conservative veteran. Really, a pro-sanctuary state, pro-Black Lives Matter mayor who's voted in 7 of the last 8 Democrat primaries. That's what you call a conservative, Carl? Is that right?
Well, are they getting paid off, too, by Ken Griffin to say this? Is Laura Ingraham? Well, how did he get on Fox?
For friends of friends. I mean, this is political favors, but whatever it is. This is the establishment closing ranks, which is what they do. This was supposed to be this way, and the voters are poised to make it a different way, and you're not listening to us. You have to listen to us. Now, you can say, well, Carl Rove's just making an argument. He is, and I'm making mine. It's fine. Voters will decide. I'm fine with that.
In 12 days.
The other thing that Carl fails to address, much like he fails to address how George W. Bush's compassionate conservatism, a redundancy, and big government republicanism, which is what that translated into, ushered in Obama. Much as he doesn't want to explain how what turned out to be ill-conceived forays in war and nation building in the Middle East ushered in Obama. But it wasn't just post 9/11. It was Medicare expansion, big government conservatism. Government, we're going to make government work. We grow it because that means we can provide more benefits. And even if our intentions are laudable, if the vehicle's wrong, the outcome is going to be poor.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline. You can also text us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
See, that's the establishment's deal. It's the same thing in Illinois. We're never wrong. And we're never accountable when things go wrong when we're in charge. We're not responsible. Outside forces. And when we are rejected as the combine Republicans are about to be rejected on June 28th in the governor's race here. Well, we're already going to set up the argument about how you should have listened to us. You nominated the wrong guy. You didn't listen to us. So when you lose in November, it's your fault. When we lose in November, like with Bruce Rauner in 2018, after spending a primary campaign lying and alienating almost half of the Republican primary electorate, not our fault. Not our fault. Bad year, Trump, Pritzker's money, all sorts of excuses. Not our fault. We're in charge. What Rauner's governorship, not our fault. We were in charge, not our fault. No, Madigan, Cullerton, they made us do it. They made us make a permanent increase in their income tax. They made us sign the most radical, at the time, pro-abortion law in the country. They made us make Illinois a sanctuary state. Not our fault. Never their fault. And then they nominate a candidate, Karl Rove, apparently he doesn't do opposition research anymore. They nominate a candidate, and you know, and I've made plenty of mistakes in electoral politics before, and I've blown through too many red lights before in previous campaigns, so I know what it looks like. They nominate a candidate, they look at it on paper, they sell a guy that says it will come in with overwhelming resources and say, there it is. And then they make completely imbecilic arguments, contradictory arguments. First half of the campaign, Darren Bailey is a rhino who supported Biden over Trump. Second half of the campaign, when they're flailing, Darren Bailey's too conservative for Illinois. Which is it? Which one is it?
I'm just getting sick of it. all the ads and the flyers and all that.
And so they blew through all the red lights. They blew through all the red lights on Richard Ervin. They thought they could flim-flam their way through another primary with a flim-flam man, because that's what they do.
And don't forget those 60-plus Republicans, state lawmakers, who signed on to support him.
Oh, I don't.
I mean, never forget who they are, because
I lost
a lot of friends on that one.
But right, there are a bunch of...
And question them, like, how much are you getting paid? What were you promised? And what are you doing? And the more that you know about him, are you ready to cross your name off the list?
No, yeah,
especially that one with his girlfriend and that... I mean, that whole thing is just a debacle, too. Just speaks to his character or lack of character.
Right, because they're a bunch of welfare queens. We lost one billionaire in Rauner. I need somebody else to write checks. I don't want to work. I don't have to make an argument. I don't want to have to stand for anything. I just want to make sure I got, you know, somebody in my corner that can write checks so I can overwhelm any potential opponent with money to protect my little piece of turf in this, political turf in the state. That's the disposition of most of the Republican Party under the wonderful stewardship of Jim Durkin and now Dan McConkie, Bill Brady before him, Tom Cross before Durkin. It's been the same deal. Blew through all those red lights. We'll shine on those conservatives, three quarters of the primary electorate. We'll tell lies about their opponents as needed. We'll try to threaten at least some of their opponents out of the race, which they did. Then we'll tell lies about them and threaten to destroy them, which they did. Mm-hmm. Then they'll believe that they can, with their money, hoodwink at least a plurality of the Republican electorate to win the nomination. And, you know, all this stuff about he supports sanctuary state and a lie with Pritzker and Lightfoot. And he went right along with Pritzker with all the COVIDian lockdown policies, imposed the vaccine mandate. He told the police to stand down when the riots came to roar in the summer of 2020. He's a strong and enthusiastic supporter of Black Lives Matter. His own words, he's conflicted about the riots because that's how that sort of disruption is how you bring about change. He plays the identitarian card. He votes in Democrat socialist primaries. He's a grifter in Aurora doing pay to play deals like any other hack politician in the state. We can just set all that aside. Nobody's allowed to pay attention to it. Nobody's allowed to express concerns about it. Because we got it. Don't worry about it. We got this one. And, you know, do you want to win or not? And as I said the other day, what do we win when we win? Just the other half of the combine?
And when Ervin loses, is he going to support the nominee?
That's his choice.
Is he going to go back to being a Democrat?
That's his choice. They win always. And Illinois never does. Don't you find that curious? Even when a putative Republican wins something important, Illinois continues to lose. Do you find that odd? Karl Rove doesn't. Greg and Schomburg.
I thought the Combine's disparagement of Jeannie Ives was bad. But this, what they're doing to Darren Bailey is just beyond reproach. It is evil. And I certainly hope that all of you folks out there recognize it and don't vote for him, because there's a lot of media out there that's getting that squishy vote that doesn't listen to the show, and you need to reach out to them and tell them exactly what's going on. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. I mean, this race, Bailey has extended a lead, but still 12 days. I'm not saying this is a fait accompli. Never, ever say that until all the votes are counted.
It's a sizable lead with, 36%? And Richard Irvin's got, 20 or 20?
The Trafalgar poll that was out yesterday had a 37-20.
Okay.
That's something else, too. You know, this isn't just about Darren Bailey and Richard Irvin. This is about the Republican primary electorate in this state. It's about the Republican Party in this state. And it will go unnoticed by the Rahner consultants, the Ken Griffin gatekeeper, Kasen Carter, who, you know, facilitated this conspiracy of fools. Let's say that that's the final spread. So you'll take judicial notice of the fact that 4 in 5 Republican primary voters voted for somebody who's actually conservative and against the guy who had $50 million to try to convince people he wasn't, and that those other conservatives, that he was, and that those other conservatives weren't. I mean, this is, add Bailey's vote up with whatever Bailey gets, with Rabine, with Sullivan, with Schimpf, with Solomon. That's the conservative vote. But we shouldn't have a conservative. We're not allowed to have a conservative representing the Republican Party, because Karl Rove and the moribund, compromised GOP leadership, in quotation marks, says so. Because that's not what they want. And they don't appreciate that that disconnect is why we've been in super minority hell for the past two generations. And to tell me, somebody make this make sense for me, because I'm struggling. Mike in Plano.
Hey, Dan, you know, whenever you hear these establishment, corporate, Fox News, Republican types use the phrase suburbs or suburban women, et cetera, what they're telling you is a principled conservative is that in order to become more appealing among the general public and in order to get them to like you more, you have to be more socially liberal. You have to be more accepting of LGBT. Talk about abortion as little as possible. Yeah, it's okay to support red flag laws because it'll keep the guns out of the hands of bad guys, et cetera. And it's not just Karl Rove. You look at people like Sean Hannity, who no longer has a Trump train to cling to. He's going back to his old days as another Republican toady. If you watch his show, he always has Herschel Walker and Leo Terrell on to tell you how much he loves black people. Has Caitlyn Jenner on to tell you how much he loves gay people. I'll vote for Mehmet Oz. He's a strong conservative. It's just more useless pandering, and you're seeing it reflect in the Republican primary electorate, especially in these races down south, because unfortunately, you're seeing people like Nancy Mace and Brian Kemp and Steve Scalise, John Cornyn, all these people keep getting reelected over and over again by the same constituents who say that they're against the establishment.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. Not all of them. Rice in South Carolina certainly didn't. Fran in Aurora.
Good morning.
Morning.
So you're right on spot. I'm from Aurora. Richard Irvin has only run in nonpartisan races. I went to the Republican establishment. I told them he was a Democrat. His It's documented. Yeah. If he gets through, the people, the voters in the state will have, say, just a choice, the kind of choice that we have now in Aurora. It's one Democrat or the other.
Has he been effective as all, at all as your mayor?
He's rode the coattails of the business establishment here that have been allowed to come in, but there's been a price to pay.
You're the Aurora.
I don't know that much about it. I can tell you, I have friends who stood on the line during the riots. They were told to stand down. Everybody, this has been out there. But if he gets through, people should know. Their choice will be like the choice we have, which is one Democrat or the other.
You're the Aurora Republican Township Chairman, right?
That's correct.
And so what's his involvement been with the Republican Party locally?
None. Richard is not a precinct committeeman. He is not a member of the Aurora Township Republicans.
Well, that says it all right there.
Thanks for the call, Fran. Appreciate it. Chuck, Northwest Side.
Yeah, hi, Dan and Amy.
Hey.
Yesterday in the mail, I got from the Democratic Party telling me that Darren Bailey is so conservative that he's almost Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get from the Illinois conservative that he's just a flaming liberal who's going to tear apart everything. And so who's right? I mean, how are we supposed to tell when they pull this kind of stuff?
Well, with Bailey, it's pretty straightforward because he's got a record. Thanks for the call, Chuck. Also public positions and legislation filed and all sorts of things that speak to that. Whoever, other than Richard Ervin, whoever the nominee is going to be characterized as Hitler because that's what the left does. Every Republican is Hitler. George W. Bush was Hitler.
Right.
Karl Rove seems to forget that sort of hysterical character assassination the left does, regardless of who their opponent is.
I remember thinking Rod DeSantis. His opponent said he's Hitler too.
Of course, it happens all the time. It's all that is stock and trade. So you think that somebody is going to get like a pass on some issues? Richard Ervin's middling answers on abortion or guns. You think they're not going to characterize if he were the nominee, they wouldn't characterize him the same way they'll characterize a Darren Bailey? Then you haven't been paying any attention to how the left operates, including in this state. Even with so-called moderate, that they did that to Bruce Rauner. He and his wife raised money for Personal PAC, the pro-abortion outfit in this state. They're Planned Parenthood donors, for God's sakes. And they characterized him when he was running and running for re-election, even after signing the law, as an opponent of women's rights and so on and so forth. That's all the left has. So stop worrying about what they're going to say about us and start telling people who we are. It's the John Wooden playbook that the Republican Party has refused to run in this state for basically as long as I've been around. Don't worry about what the other side is doing. If we do what we're supposed to do, it won't matter what they're doing.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I want to share a story, just as sort of a cautionary tale.
Yes.
So yesterday morning, I was robbed at a local gas station.
Are you like okay?
A half mile from my house while filling up my car. After it happened, I gathered myself together, still a little bit, in shock at what happened. Money was gone. I called the police. They got there just in a matter of minutes. They were great. They, called for medical assistance and
Are you
and
okay?
After they realized my blood pressure needed my 120 life, my blood pressure was through the roof. I had no idea they did that type of checking after a robbery, but I'm grateful. After I calmed down a bit, the police asked me if I knew who robbed me, and I immediately told them, yeah, I do. It was right over there, pump number 4.
Ah!
Thank you. Thank you very much. I had you going, though.
You did. You stink.
That was my...
That's so rude. Here's me being a dummy. A blonde move. Oh, yeah. You did? I'm so sorry. You okay?
Yeah. Pump number four is a culprit.
Oh, my God.
My friend Rich Cavelli sent that joke. Hilarious. Oh, he's a funny guy. Funny guy.
Yeah, but right. I feel robbed. I mean, normally it takes $65-$70 to fill up my tank. Yesterday, $117.
Yeah.
And that's money. I mean, when they say the average, you know, household of four is going to be paying $500 more a month because of inflation, they mean it. So you better start preparing now. And this one woman, Christina Seal, she's a single mom, special ed teacher. This is an idea, folks, if you need that extra income. She's selling her plasma and making $600 a month.
It's something that I have to do in order to keep my family afloat, in order to make sure that there is enough food to go around and the lights are on and I've got gas in my gas tank.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Well, it's getting bad for a lot of Americans, which means it's getting bad for the political leadership starting in the White House.
Good.
And you don't have to believe me. Listen to this exchange between CNN data reporter. Yeah, CNN data reporter Harry Enten and Gloria Vanderbilt's kid talking about Biden and inflation. This is something. Remember, this is on CNN.
Okay.
Put this inflation in context. How bad is the surge in prices?
It's awful. I mean, it's awful, and how people feel about it is even worse. You know, you look at the consumer sentiment right now, and what do you see? This is the worst consumer sentiment ever measured by the University of Michigan, going all the way back since 1952.
Wow.
You basically, even if you double my age, that doesn't get you back to 1952. And while I'm young, I'm not that young, right? The second worst, 1980. The third worst, 1980. I don't have to remind you. Inflation got Jimmy Carter. It killed that presidency. And in terms of why are consumers feeling this bad? Well, it's pretty clear why they're feeling this bad. And that is because the consumer price index is the worst it's ever been in a midterm cycle since 74. It's the worst it's been in any presidential cycle or midterm cycle since 1980. So it's not much of a surprise. You can see it. It's literally off the charts on the table on your screen.
And how does President Biden's performance rate?
Awful.
I mean, I knew that was the answer.
The answer is awful. I mean, you know, I'll compare it to Carter at this point in his presidency, right? Look at the disapproval rating Joe Biden has on inflation right now. It's over 70%. Carter was not even there at this point in mid-1978. When you're doing worse than Jimmy Carter's doing in the minds of Americans on inflation, you know that they're holding you responsible for the conditions that are currently on the ground that are hurting Americans in their pocketbooks.
Wow, CNN refusing to keep up appearances. That's not good news for the big guy. And, of course, their response from the White House, from the big guy, is to do what? Look for scapegoats.
Right. It's Putin's somebody else's fault.
Putin's price hike and, of course, those big, bad oil companies. He sent a letter to those big, bad oil companies telling them to pump it up.
Well, yeah, he wrote
it. Like Hans and Franz. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, he wrote, you know, quote, this is part of the letter that he wrote to the seven major oil companies. At a time of war, refinery profit margins well above normal being passed directly onto American families are not acceptable.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, and they say, you know, this is because they're down 3 million barrels a day since 2020. But that's because they say Biden's White House has been hostile because of this go green. Six refineries have gone offline to meet new environmental standards, and that's a problem.
Well, one of the few still trying to keep up appearances, and she's got a script she can read from, which helps.
Oh,
that's KJP, the quadruple threat, Karine Jean-Pierre. Mm-hmm. She had to defend that pointed letter to the oil and gas CEOs, to the D.C. press corps. Here's what she said.
We see it as a patriotic duty, as we've talked about, there's war happening right now in Ukraine that was caused by Russia, which is why we're seeing these hikes in gas prices, especially since Russia has started amassing troops on the border. We've seen a $2 increase of gas prices. So we know where to put the blame on the war, but oil companies, they have oil refineries, they have responsibility too. What they have been doing is taking advantage of the war, and as I showed earlier, they have tripled their income, and so this is a problem. But what we're trying to do by putting out the letter, we are saying, hey, we need you to act. It is time to act. We want to have a conversation. We want to come to a solution. There is going to be a conversation later this week, I believe, with the Energy Department, and so that's going to happen. So this is basically a bit of a, hey, we want you to act. It's time to act. We have done our part with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the one million a day for the next 6 months, and so we need them to act. So that's where we are. We want to come to solutions, which is why we say we want to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm. No, they need to drop the silly restrictions that are on certain oil refineries.
Oil companies are unpatriotic. They're war profiteers. Is that your view? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. If they're unpatriotic, if they're treasonous, if they're war profiteers, well, what's the administration going to do if they don't accede to the administration's demands?
Well, it is.
I don't have anything right now to preview as to what would come next. But what I will say is that we are calling on them to do the right thing, to be patriots here, and not to use the war as an excuse or as a reason to not put out a production, not to do the capacity that is needed out there, so that the prices can come down.
Yeah, maybe time for the federal government to seize the oil company.
API, they say oil refineries are working at or near capacity to keep up with demand.
Maybe it's time for the federal government to seize the oil companies.
We don't know what the
consequences are. Well, what if they don't comply? What if they refuse to be patriotic?
That would start a civil war. But surging fuel prices, Dan, are so bad that certain first responders aren't responding to non-emergencies. Here's the police chief from South Zanesville, Ohio.
Until the prices come down, we're going to have to adjust our budgets, and we're raising our budget up to 62%, and we're going to be over our budget if it continues.
So they're telling officers not to idle their vehicles and do stationary traffic control rather than patrol and drive up and down streets and don't respond to non-emergencies. It's in Zanesville. It's also in Allegan County Sheriff's Office in Michigan. Same thing.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Again,
bad.
As the Wall Street Journal opined, what do you know? President Biden suddenly discovered that a refinery shortage is driving up fuel prices, naturally blaming refiners, even as the administration doubles down on policies that created the refining shortage in the first place.
Boom.
Of course.
Drop mic. That's the problem. Not Putin.
And this is the point that our friend Scott Shelley made the other day when he was on the program. The thing that is so maddening about the level of inflation being experienced is so much of it could be alleviated if you would change your energy policies. But that's the one thing the Biden administration won't do.
No.
One million barrels from the strategic reserve a day for 6 months. 1 million. America consumes 20 million barrels a day. That's nothing. It has it has marginal impact.
And petroleum
used
for more than gas, too. And what this
of
one,
course,
right?
I mean,
I know, but people don't know that, Dan.
We've gone through this before many times. Yes, what people don't know, but I mean, Mark Perry does a great job over at Carpe Diem, reminding every 6 months or so, listing the hundreds of products that are petroleum-based products that have nothing to do with fueling cars. That's right. Ted in Little Italy, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know, every day I wake up. And everything that's going on is insane. And I keep thinking, is today the day I got to sandbag my windows and get ready for a civil war? Why is nothing? I just can't believe the American people aren't just pounding on their representatives' doors, demanding that this asshack that we pull out of office. I mean, it's incredible. They attack Trump every single day on any little thing. And this is just skating by. I just can't believe it. And Chicago is a test ground for the entire country of corruption and everything else going on. I can't get a cop at my house. If no. guy's kicking down my neighbor's door, 30 minutes of calls, no police. It's insane.
Thanks for the call, Ted.
Yeah,
I mean,
carjacking victims are waiting almost 2 hours. It's ridiculous. But I don't like living in Biden's America. This is not a sustainable system. And I'm feeling the same feeling when COVID restrictions happened, where you just have no control over your life because the government is so big and is just, you know, taking advantage of everything just to push their agenda. They want, you know, fossil fuel. They want alternative energy. The solar panel bull jive that's going on, too. The whole thing.
Holman Jenkins has a good piece on this, too. Don't underestimate how politics is playing into this. And I don't mean their ideological disposition against fossil fuels. That's, I mean, in addition to that.
Okay.
Because inflation, he writes, is a cost spread lightly over everyone. I mean, you know, lightly over everyone, obviously heavier on some than others. We've talked about this. Who gets hurt the most? The people at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, of course. But because inflation is a cost lightly spread over everyone, whereas unemployment lands especially hard on specific individuals and families, it's natural for economists to urge the Fed to accept a little more inflation, a little longer, protect employment, and strive for a soft landing. It's also necessary for the Biden administration to keep up this argument they're making, which is not going to fly, but they're trying to say we're in a historically good place because look at how low the unemployment number is. People have jobs. And so don't believe your lying eyes. Things are actually going pretty well and we're poised for stable growth in the near term. That's their argument. I don't think very many people are buying it, but it could be a lot worse if you saw unemployment start to spike, which it is likely to do, as again, our friend Scott Shelody mentioned the other day. But he goes on to say, don't underestimate how much the determination to prevent a Trump restoration now permeates the establishment, with quite a few Republicans quietly on board. You may have noticed Democrats are investing in a big televised Jan 6 pseudo-prosecution for one reason, to inoculate America against a Trump revival that Democrats would likely only be able to oppose with the lackluster Joe Biden or lackluster Kamala Harris. Many of the institutions that matter most already can be heard sounding off on the need to avoid an 80s-like recession, even if the cost is more inflation. Jerome Powell and his Fed Reserve colleagues are hardly insensate to the risk that their inflation-fighting actions might bring Trump back to power. Politically, it could get worse for Biden. Stagflation, a recession, unemployment starts to spike, and inflation becomes that genie you can't get, or demon you can't get back into the netherworld. And so the infusion of electoral politics in terms of understanding the policy choices that are being made, always present. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Yes, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I've been listening all morning, and the question that I have is, can you simply explain how does raising the interest rates at this time help the American people, and how does it bring down the gas prices in an inflation? I don't understand that. If you can explain simply, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, this is the – thanks for the call, Rich. I mean, this is – you're trying to reduce demand. So you make credit more expensive, and you you let ostensibly the soft landing that they're going for, you let production catch up to demand. That's the sort of one sentence answer. Judy Shelton over at the Independence Institute has a good piece about the folly of these central bankers and the potential unintended consequences of these interest hikes, which we'll get to perhaps a little bit later. George and Moni.
Hey, Dan. Biden's timing is always awful. If he'd have written his letter during the toilet paper shortage, then maybe. But, you know.
Okay. Right. So if he would have gone after big toilet paper, we could get, yeah, right.
Oh, and thanks, by the way, that baby formula plant in Michigan closed down again for flooding. Yeah, so they're going to be shut down for another 2 to 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, you know, the refineries are running at 94% capacity. That's what I read a couple days ago. We haven't built a new refinery in this country in, I don't know, 50 years. 1970s, we've expanded them, but we haven't built a new one. We closed several down for biodiesel fuel. I mean, these people are idiots. They have no concept of really how to get gas prices down. We need more refining capacity, so we need. But on the political side of this, I wanted to say that, you know, this inflation is going to be a potential game changer in the elections this year and in 2024. Look at what happened in 1980. I mean, Bailey could beat Pritzker because of this inflation. This is going to be the big issue in November. So let's not discount that Bailey could beat him. In 1980, you had Warren Magnuson lose. He was a senator for 36 years. Birch Bayh from Indiana lost.
Yeah.
Herman Talmadge lost in 1980. Several other, you know, Frank Church in Idaho. I mean, these were guys who had been there for a long time. They were liberal icons, and they got their butts kicked. I think Birch Bayh lost by 166,000 votes to Dan Quayle. So, you know, and Dan Quayle was just a congressman from northeastern Indiana. So it's the kind of event that could really dramatically alter the political landscape, including in our governor's race. I really believe that.
I agree with that, Frank. I think that's a good observation. And don't forget, particularly because it's not just that Jelly Belly has a D next to his name, is that he was a full-on embracer of all of the COVIDian funny money printing and spending, which is part and parcel of why we're here. He is full-on with the Keynesian monetarism and the big government distribution of funny money. And so he's got to wear the jacket for that, too, if we can find one that fits him. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, in our continuing effort to bring you the candidates on the ballot for the June 28th primary, just 12 days away. We turn our attention to the Republican primary for Attorney General to face incumbent Kwame Raoul.
Who?
Right,
no, I mean, seriously, what is he? Do you ever hear from him or see him? Or maybe once.
Attorney generals.
I sued Pritzker, but no, he didn't send himself. He sent his top guy.
Attorney generals, when Democrats are in power and they're Democrats, are to be
what?
Seen, not heard. You know, like little Lisa Madigan.
Oh, yeah.
Kwame Raoul is the incumbent. Among the Republican candidates running, David Shistokas and Steve Kim. That's the Ken Griffin slate.
Yeah, and he did not answer. He's not coming on today.
He declined our invitation. And downstate attorney Tom DeVore, who got attention in being the lead attorney on class action lawsuits against Pritzker COVIDian policies. But we start with Mr. Shistokas. And this is what I like about him from reading from his bio. I didn't become a lawyer until I was 35. It's only recently that I've practiced law longer than I sold beer. His grandfather started wholesaling beer on Chicago's South Side in 1933. And David said, I delivered my first case of beer with my dad when I was 5 years old. David, thanks for joining us. Did you ever think about taking the Jim Oberweis model when he passed out ice cream at every campaign stop? Why don't you pass out beer at every campaign stop? You know how many votes you could get?
Quite a few, I think, Dan.
Yeah, I
think quite a few. You know, but I actually, as it turns out, I'm a beer guy with a law degree, you know.
Oh, that's dangerous. And
so why'd you make the conversion?
That's kind of a longer story as well. And that goes back to my grandfather as well, that when I was about seven or so, he saw me on a bench, actually at their retirement place in Wakanda. And I was giving a speech to a whole bunch of other kids. And my grandfather walked by and said, that young boy is going to become a lawyer. And you know what?
With a tear in his eye, he said that, I'm sure.
You know, I don't think so. I think Grandpa was very, very proud. We were very, very excited about any number of things. But he had started the beer business, as you said, on the south side of Chicago. We were Schlitz Wholesalers there for about 60-some-odd years. I grew up there. I went to St. Symphorosa on the, as a kid, Nathan Hale School. So I'm a, that's one of the interesting things, I think, in terms of what Republicans always say. They say, we'd be great except for Cook County, but they never have like a Cook County guy. I grew up in the city. I actually sat two rows behind the first Mayor Daley at White Sox games when I was a kid. I've got
nice seats.
Yeah, they were excellent seats, but I've got programs that are autographed by Minnie Minoso and Richard J. Daley. We've got
I like the Minoso autograph, but what has your legal career been? Explain what you've done as an attorney and how you envision your role as Attorney General.
Certainly, I'm a former Cook County Assistant State's Attorney. I was appointed by Jack O'Malley, the last Cook County-wide Republican office holder, and so I just want to point that out. Is while I was a Cook County State's Attorney, it was through the good offices of Jack O'Malley that I was appointed there, and then ultimately during the course of my career there, I did over 400 felony prosecutions and more than 10,000 misdemeanors. And I just might point out that there isn't criminal prosecution authority in the Attorney General's office, and neither of my opponents have any experience in that regard. And I think that's worthwhile. More recently, I've been involved in many election issues, really actually across the country. Back in 2016, I was with the Trump Rubio campaign, primarily in Broward County, Florida, and there I discovered 150,000 illegally opened ballots that would have been opened behind doors if people want to look that up. That's there's Shostakis, Miami Herald. If they look at that, there's stories about that. More recently, I was with the lawyers for Trump during the course of 2020, in October, November, in Pennsylvania. I ultimately wound up in court with Mayor Giuliani. I testified before the Pennsylvania Senate on matters, on election matters that let's call it irregularities. I actually do a whole hour on Pennsylvania, if that's of interest sometime. During the course of the pandemic, I actually filed suit on behalf of Standing in the Word Ministries in Grundy County regarding restrictions on church practice during the pandemic. And within a couple of weeks, we had Standing in the Word Ministries opened up and operating in as if, for all practical matters, that J.B. Pritzker didn't exist. I also have more recently, also on election matters, I'm representing the Illinois Conservative Union in federal court against the Illinois State Board of Elections regarding getting voter data, simply to see whether or not the board is doing their job in terms of keeping election information and voter rolls clean, as they're required to do under the National Voter Registration Act. There's
David,
something called Section 8.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you think we have fair elections here in Illinois?
You know, that's one of the things of what that suit is designed to do. And, you know, the Board of Elections said we couldn't have they said they denied our ability to have the data. And I might point out that, in fact, it's the Attorney General, Mr. Raul, who all we're asking the board to do is obey the law. And Mr. Raul essentially is telling citizens of the state of Illinois that their government does not have to obey the law.
Right. They are.
And that's
the
a
law.
Dangerous place to start.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Go ahead.
No. So, I mean, thinking about corruption, because, you know, previous attorneys general have been criticized for not doing enough to root out public corruption. I mean, recently departed Jim Ryan received some criticism when he ran for governor for not doing enough to root out corruption in the George Ryan administration. Obviously, Lisa Madigan, Mike's little girl, not doing enough to root out corruption in state government with her father as House Speaker. How do you view that office? And that could be somewhat fairly and unfairly, because, of course, you have the federal prosecutors doing most of the heavy lifting when it comes to public corruption in Chicago and Illinois. I get that. So how do you view your role as Attorney General when it comes to rooting out public corruption?
You know, it's embarrassing regarding the situation when you just mentioned that the federal prosecutors are doing the heavy lifting. You know, I was given a talk in Mendota, Illinois, and there was a couple of speakers shortly before me, a few days after the Madigan indictments, and they were all, you know, going, "This is wonderful," et cetera. And I got up and I said, "You know, this is embarrassing. Do you think that the whole situation regarding no-show jobs and Commonwealth Edison, the other allegations in there, you think that didn't break any Illinois laws?" The fact is, yeah, it's just, it is embarrassing the fact that this office has never been utilized to its appropriate extent to do that. You know, the Illinois Attorney General, people don't generally understand that it's an independently elected office, owes no duty to the governor, the government, the Department of Public Health, the Board of Education, the Board of Elections, all alphabet soup of agencies. Actually, there's something called the Illinois Attorney General Act, and the Illinois Attorney General Act actually says the first duty of the Attorney General is to represent the people of the state of Illinois, not the governor, as I said. And that I might call attention. You said at the opening, you mentioned that Mr. Kim is associated with Mr. Irvin, and from a campaign standpoint, it seems like Mr. DeVore is closely associated with Mr. Bailey. And Mr. Rowe obviously has been doing heavy lifting for Governor Pritzker, and previously we had the Speaker's daughter. How's that all working out for you when you have these political relationships between the Attorney General and either the governor or the Speaker? These are the kinds of things that get in the way of the Attorney General doing the job that the Illinois Constitution envisions.
I just wanted to get this too because it's just sort of interesting and gives some sort of texture to you as an individual as well as a candidate. You write about a near-death experience you had and how that informed the way that you have lived your life going forward. Can you relate that story?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. In January 2nd, 2020, I was actually in a courtroom in Rolling Meadows, awaiting my case to be called, and the deputy sheriff that was in charge of the courtroom there came over and said, "Dave, you don't look so good." You know, I said, "No, I'm just a little thirsty." And the deputy said, "No, you're turning all gray." And on his own, he called the paramedics, and they were there in a few minutes. And before terribly long, I was within in the emergency room in the Northwest Community Hospital in Arlington Heights. And you know, I wasn't aware of this at the time, but there's about a two minute journey on a gurney from the ER to the cath lab, and they pre-wire you for the possibility that in case your heart might stop during the course of that 2 minute trip. And in fact, my heart did stop during the course of that 2 minute trip. There was a nurse walking alongside that gave me appropriate shocks. I don't know exactly the time frame. I do know that it was about 20 minutes later that I actually came back. But during the course of that time, I did in fact have the experience where everything went black. Door began to open inwards, bright white light up in the left-hand corner, then shone down in there. And it's a white light that you can't describe in actual English terms. But what opened up on the other side was a castle from Lithuania. It's called Trakai. My heritage is Lithuanian. And actually in the early 90s, I went to Lithuania several times with lawyers of Lithuanian heritage from around the world to help them write their new constitution after the fall of the Soviet Union, which was an incredible experience. But at any rate, on the other side of the water between myself and the castle were both my grandfathers, neither of whom one of whom I had known when he was elderly, and one of whom had passed before I was alive. But I quite knew what I was doing, or quite knew that that's who I was experiencing. And they, in fact, we had, in fact, and communication again. I've studied NDEs in the meantime. A lot of people seem to embellish what their experiences are, most of which you cannot describe. But I can tell you that ever since that time, I ask every day why it is that he brought me back. And I get an answer regularly. I ultimately wound up in prayer with David Smith of the Illinois Family Institute, and talked about this possibility of running for Attorney General, and David Smith said the prayer that has guided me ever since, and that is to send the assets and the people that I need at the time that I need them, and to give me the wisdom to recognize them when they arrive. And that's been happening ever since January 2nd, 2020.
You mentioned Tom DeVore, one of your opponents. Tom DeVore has filed a civil suit against you and other parties for defamation, claiming that you defamed him by accusing him of domestic abuse. How do you respond? I know it's pending litigation, but how do you respond to that defamation?
Well, it's easy. I can say that, first of all, that's a mischaracterization, Dan. If you take a look at the suit, I know you have a legal background. It says that the lawsuit is actually against his married girlfriend's mother, accusing her of saying nasty things about Mr. DeVore. There's another column below that says respondents, which is mislabeled according to the statute. It's supposed to say respondents in discovery, and it alleges that somehow or other, I, my sister, and Bobby Payton, a candidate for the United States Senate, somehow or other, had contact with Ms. Craig, his married girlfriend's mother, indicating that we somehow or other either guided her or helped her or know something about what it is she did. We are not defendants in the lawsuit. It's and it was mischaracterized and mislabeled and miscaptioned. The statute requires you to say respondents in discovery.
But yes, but the substance of the charge that you were in cahoots with the girlfriend's mom, that's the question.
No, it's not, Dan. It doesn't say that we were.
Well, are you?
Well, you're respondents in discovery, so it's alleging involvement, I guess, is the point. And so the question is, were you involved?
And, no, I've never met the woman. I've okay. never had any communication with her. I never had a text message. I never had a Facebook message. I don't know. I do not know the woman whatsoever.
Okay. Well, that's what we wanted to understand. All right.
Yeah,
well,
no.
David Shostokas, he is a Republican candidate for Attorney General on the June 28th ballot, a week from Tuesday. More information about his candidacy and campaign, davidshostokas.com. Is that right?
Well, the campaign website is dave4ag.com.
Okay. Dave4ag. Dave4ag.com. Dave4ag.com. David Shostokas. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck on the 28th.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're discussing the Illinois Attorney General's race, the Republican primary for Illinois Attorney General. And we heard from David Shostokas, one of the candidates. We're going to hear from Tom DeVore, one of the other candidates. The third candidate, just as an aside very quickly before we hear from Tom DeVore, is Steve Kim. You may remember Steve Kim. He was the running mate for Dan Rutherford, his LG candidate, back in 2014 with former State Senator Rutherford's ill-fated gubernatorial bid in the primary that Bruce Rauner won.
That's right.
I've known Steve Kim for a long time. I like Steve Kim. Always been friendly with him. I think it's pathetic and ironic that the Ken Griffin slated candidates won't come on this show to answer questions. We've treated candidates for the offices that we've tackled running in primaries against one another. We've treated them all fairly, I believe. And we treat Steve Kim fairly. And John Millhiser for Secretary of State, he didn't want to come on. You know, it's funny.
And Richard Irvin won't go to our debates.
Well, of course. And won't come on the show, of course. You know, it's funny how poorly the Rose Garden strategy is working out for Irvin and his slated candidates who have primary challenges. Dan Brady, I think, is going to beat Millhiser for Secretary of State.
I hope so.
The Illinois Attorney General race is very close. And yet the Irvin campaign, by the way, I think a lot of these slated candidates below Irvin got sold a bill of goods, because I don't think very much money has been spent on their campaigns and their candidacies at all, which is, you know, I think something I said would happen at the outset, particularly if Irvin ran into any trouble, and that's precisely what's happened. But secondly, the Irvin campaign has spent tens of thousands of dollars, probably hundreds of thousands of dollars on our airwaves with their canned messages for Irvin, against Bailey, whatever. And yet the candidates, none of the candidates want to come on the show. You're willing to present a canned message to our listeners, but you're not willing to come on the show and have a conversation?
No, they're doing the Biden strategy. They're not campaigning. I mean, it's, you know, Steve Kim's another person who I met at that Republican fundraiser who said, oh, yeah, we'll come on your show. We'd love to.
It's so cowardly.
Yeah.
In addition to that, embarrassing. In addition to that, it is political incompetence by those genius Rauner and before and many other, you know, surrender Republicans before Rauner, the consultants that are part of the men and women of Always down in Springfield. It's just so interesting. Anyway, that's their choice, and so good for them. Coming up, though, is Tom DeVore. We've talked to Tom before on the show before because he's been
the
lead attorney on a number of suits against the powers that be in Illinois during the pandemic. Lightfoot, the Illinois Department of Corrections, Pritzker, with respect to CPS, with respect to and many other school districts, with respect to all those COVID mandates. Tom DeVore joins us now. Tom, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, sir.
Morning. Before we get to litigation that we've talked to you about in some detail previously, I just wanted to pick up on something we ended our conversation with David Shostokas on, which is this defamation suit you filed in which you name, among others, Shostokas as a respondent in discovery, alleging that he and others were involved in a false claim against you of domestic abuse. Could you provide some background on that?
Yeah, they were named as respondents in discovery, and they were named that because we know that Ms. Craig acted in concert with those respondents in discovery.
Ms. Craig is your girlfriend's mother.
That's correct. And she's been, this lady, again, there's something wrong with her. She has been one of the most deviant people I've dealt with in my life. And for the last 2 years, she's just been relentless, making up lies. It's all unfounded. None of it's true. And again, before we filed that case, Dan, we know, and I'm glad to hear, I was listening to your show when Mr. Shostokas was on, and I know that's being recorded because we already know, we have direct knowledge that he acted in concert with her. I wouldn't have named them if I didn't already know it. So,
do you have proof that he texted her, or do you have any evidence?
We have direct knowledge from people that know that they were communicating together and that document that was spread around, they acted in concert putting that out into the public. So we do know.
So, this is an issue that could be, if you're the nominee, could be, well, I'm sure will be raised again in a general election against Kwame Raoul. So just so we're clear, there has never been an order of protection, any arrests regarding this or any other issue? Okay.
No, it's 100% false. 100%.
Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about some other matters. Your rise to some prominence in Illinois over the last 24 months because of the COVID mandates, where you represented parties that were obviously negatively impacted by the shutdown orders and other COVID mandates. Why did you decide to intercede and represent so many different plaintiffs on so many different COVID-related mandates?
Because if we as people don't put an end to this executive/administrative overreach in our state and in our nation, our system of government, as we have known it since we founded this nation, is going to go away, Dan. So, you know, we don't govern ourselves through the executive branch the way that this has been happening. It's completely inappropriate. And it's, again, it leads to tyranny, and that's not just Tom's opinion, that's history. And so I interceded and started protecting people because we can't allow that type of behavior from our government to exist. It's just
it's going to lead down a path that's irreversible.
Well, I don't know if you heard, but they've already announced that next year, Chicago Public Schools are going to be testing. Again, they're going to continue this craziness into next year. So if you're around somebody who has COVID and you're not vaccinated, you have to sit out for 5 days. Currently, you know, even though school's over, we still have 1,786 kids who are have been told to stay home and quarantine because they were around somebody with COVID. So how, unless parents get on this lawsuit, then they're just going to keep doing this because this seems illegal.
Well, as far as the case goes on behalf of the children, we will have an answer before the next school year starts because there's an August 10th final date in that case, Amy. Okay. We will have a resolution from the court before the next school year starts. And you know, the courts are going to have to answer these questions because the legislature won't. And one of the cases that my colleague has pending that I've been helping her with significantly, we've made it to the Supreme Court of the state of Illinois. And so hopefully they're going to give us some direction on some of these issues because there has to be answers. And the legislature won't answer them, so the courts are going to have to.
One of the other COVID-related suits you filed was on behalf of first responders against vax mandates like the ones that Mayor Lightfoot imposed. Where do vax mandates go in this state, do you think, if you have politicians that continue to try to impose them going forward?
Well, two things. One, the Supreme Court of Illinois is going to answer that, and I hope they answer it the same way the United States Supreme Court answered it, which is that it's an issue of public health beyond these agencies' authority. But what's unique, Dan, about the Chicago vaccination document, I'll call it, is leave the authority of a mayor or a city council or anything out of it. That document in the city of Chicago that people are calling a mandate or a policy, it's no more effective than a napkin because it wasn't adopted by anybody, Dan. I know you got some legal knowledge. If you look at that document, it wasn't adopted by the mayor. It wasn't adopted by the city council. It wasn't adopted by the health department. It was somebody wrote it and just said, here's our policy with no procedurally appropriate process. So it's not even a question of whether they have the authority. The document is a nullity on its face, and we're going to win that argument, and I think the mayor knows it.
We talked a bit to David Shostokas about the attorney general's role in rooting out public corruption. One issue, you know, much like what's happening at the federal level, if Republicans were able to gain control of Congress, maybe we'll have some hearings and some investigations into some of these COVIDians come next year, starting with Tony Fauci. Well, you have the sainted Dr. Ezeke, the director, Illinois director of public health, who is the subject of an ethics probe. And I wonder if that would be an example of an issue that the attorney general's office could take up if, for example, you or another Republican were attorney general.
I think that is a good example. I think we could give a lot of examples of public corruption and what the attorney general should need to do. And I would point this out, Dan. This is not just a Democrat issue. This is a Republican issue, too. There's a lot of Republican politicians in our state that have no desire to see the attorney general's office really dig in deep into public corruption. You know, it's just the reality of it. Mm-hmm. If I'm the attorney general, we will track every campaign contribution from every special interest group given to all Democrats, all Republicans. And if any of it remotely goes to the level of what Mr. Madigan was exposed for, our attorney general's office will prosecute them all indiscriminately. We won't be looking to the federal government to do it.
And that also, I would assume, goes for sort of the self-dealing. You know, you have a lot of part-time legislators that are attorneys that work in government and they secure funding for example, a municipality on one project and then turn around and are getting legal work from that municipality in terms of their private practice. I mean, that's the sort of stuff, too, the sort of soft corruption, if you will, that afflicts this state.
It is, you are exactly right. You explained it just as well as I could have. And like I said, you know, I've made it crystal clear to both parties that that's going to come to an end. That will be a huge priority for me because our government doesn't work when you got all this pay to play, hard and soft, going on around the state. And it's not unique to Illinois. It happens everywhere. But we'll put an end to it here in Illinois because the people's interests aren't served.
Pulling back a second from specific issues, can you offer our listeners a little bit of your legal background?
Certainly. I didn't get my law degree till I was 40, right around 40 years old. I was an accountant before then. And after I became an attorney, I hit the ground running doing litigation, and I've been doing it for the last 11, 12 years, something like that. So, you know, I spent a lot of time in a courtroom arguing. You know, Mr. Shostakis likes to talk about his criminal background, prosecutorial background. You know, the criminal work I've done has been on the defense side, not on the prosecutorial side. But, you know, I got the unanimous endorsement of the Fraternal Order of Police from the state lodge. So I think that speaks to what they think I'm about as it relates to law enforcement.
And you certainly have helped a number of CPS parents and parents across the state who've just, you know, you were the only one who came forward and said, I will help you. I'll take your case.
Yeah, I mean, I I've represented thousands of parents, hundreds and hundreds of businesses, you know, churches. I mean, every possible angle you can. That's all I've worked on for the last 2 years, though.
And with respect to Darren Bailey, David Shostakis suggested sort of you're to Darren Bailey what Steve Kim is to Richard Irvin. How do you respond to that?
I start laughing because, I mean, obviously all the money that Mr. Kim got. I'm not picking on Steve. I'm just stating it obvious because I'm not going to talk about any of these guys. But, you know, all the money that Mr. Kim got, he got through the Irvin slate. So they're all interconnected financially, which is a criticism that I've raised of Kwame Raoul and Governor Pritzker. Darren Bailey and I have no connections like that whatsoever. You know, no financial connections. Our funding has not come connected like Mr. Steve Kim and Mr. Richard Irvin. So completely different. You know, all our funding's been from citizens. And I've already told Darren, and I've made it clear, I don't care who the governor is. Pick one of them. If they start doing things that are beyond their authority, I'll sue each and every one of them indiscriminately. It doesn't matter to me.
He is Tom DeFore. He's a Republican candidate for Attorney General on the June 28th ballot, week from Tuesday. More information on his candidacy and campaign, Tom DeVore, D-E-V-O-R-E, D-E-V-O-R-E, TomDeVore.com is the website. Tom, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck on the 28th.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
We got to get as much use out of Five Times August as we can because Typhoid Tony is quickly trending to irrelevance.
I thought if you're vaccinated and boosted and double boosted and quadruple boosted, that you're not supposed to get the vid.
You know what happened? He didn't get his fifth jab.
Oh, that's right.
Also, he didn't wear a mask at that Nationals game about 2 years ago.
That's what did it.
And now he's Typhoid Tony. Remember what Typhoid Tony said.
When people are vaccinated, they can feel safe that they are not going to get infected.
They can feel safe they're not going to infect. What happened?
Uh-huh.
What happened?
On a more serious note, yes. And by the way, I'm glad Typhoid Tony's symptoms are mild and so on and so forth. I want him to live a long life, long enough for Rand Paul's hearings next year. Doctors' offices and hospitals are noting a concerning trend of children coming in for treatment with as many as three viruses at one point. Experts placing the blame on masking and distancing policies that reigned supreme during the COVID-19 pandemic, no less than the Amazon Post reporting. Thomas Murray, who's an infection control expert and associate professor of pediatrics at Yale, that's not typical for any time of year and certainly not typical in May and June. So possibly the policies of the last 3 years compromising the immunity,
yeah,
the immune systems of kids.
All germs aren't bad.
Just as we have Moderna and Pfizer being green-lighted to jab sub-5-year-olds. For more on this and other topics, we're pleased to be joined by Rob Long, former writer-producer for one of the best sitcoms in television history, perhaps the best, Cheers, that is. He's a co-founder of Ricochet, Ricochet.com, host of the Martini Shot podcast. Rob, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, happy to be here.
What about where we are with COVID as we're still assessing the damage from the policies that were pursued over the last couple of years, economic as well as public health related?
Well, economic policies, I think we all know. All you had to do was take your car to the gas station.
Yeah, right.
And you could figure that out. Or just trying to buy some food. You know, you could see that effect. I mean, I'm glad you said, look, I hope he is ready in recovery, speedy recovery. I hope he feels great. You know, listen, we don't want anybody to get sick ever.
Nope.
But I did have to, I mean, I have to say I'm a bad person.
Why? Because what'd you do?
Bad person.
Did you spike the football?
You giggled a little.
I did. And, you know, not out of like, oh, I hope this guy is, you know, going to have a fever, but just because, you know, everybody I know who knows this stuff, and that's not me, by the way. I mean, we've all been going through this 2-year epidemiology graduate course together. So, I mean, all those people I know who are in that job would said over and over again, everyone's going to get this. We're not going to stop it. It's not how the science or the math works. And you know, everything we knew about epidemics in October of 2019, say, so before all this started, if we had just acted as if what we knew in October of 2019 about the way viruses spread and the way these things work and just did that, we would be in a very different place right now, because this virus has behaved just like we would have predicted. It wasn't that we didn't know how these things work in the early 2020. It's that we forgot what we knew, or we just ignored what we knew. And, you know, the icing on the cake here, look, if I was writing this, I'm a writer. If I was writing this and I, you know, and somebody said, well, how about, you know, a scene where Dr. Fauci gets COVID? I would say, no, it's a little too on the nose, don't you think? We got to go a little more subtle than that.
Right, yeah. Right, so. Exactly. But here, listen to, I mean, I just want to fold in our neighbors to the north. That fifth grade drama teacher, that's the PM up in Canada, and his coterie of COVIDians. One of them, the Canadian public health director, had this to say about vaccinations going forward. You know, and this represents at least a plurality opinion in this country still.
What we also know from Dr. Tan and every other expert on COVID-19 is that although two doses still protects significantly well against severe disease and death, two doses are not enough now to protect against infection and transmission. And that is why we are transitioning now to an up-to-date vaccination definition of what it means to be adequately protected against COVID-19. Fully protected with two doses doesn't work anymore. Dr. Tam said that last Friday. It's now up-to-date vaccination that needs to be used when you talk about what Canadians should do, what we should expect of Canadians, and what this government should be expected to do in the future. As we do that, we are going to take advantage in the next few weeks and months to work closely with provinces and territories to increase significantly our rate of third doses.
And so it just continues on. You may be done with COVID, but the COVIDians aren't done with you.
No, true. Like, I just love the idea that we're just they don't even bother to hide it anymore. They just think that we're going to do it. So they're like, well, you know, obviously we're going to have 27 doses. That was clear from the very beginning. Have you had your 59th dose? Like the idea that we're going to, oh gosh, I'm so sorry, I can't come to your wedding. I haven't had my 33rd dose and my fifth booster. And we all know this. That's the problem. We walk in and like we walk into places, and I don't do that anymore. I live in New York City. They don't even ask. But even when they ask, you showed your little piece of paper.
Oh, I saw
them. They kind of like, whatever. We're all going through the motions here. So that's a very bad outcome if you're a bureaucrat. You want us to believe. And I think people now are starting to laugh and make fun and roll their eyes. Mm-mm. No one's showing their card anymore. And most doctors, I have to say, my mom is 83 years old. Her doctor says, "What, you got your two and your booster, you're fine. Just relax, you're okay."
What's the craziest COVID story you've ever heard? Because mine is my neighbor who put his groceries in the garage for 2 weeks. He didn't want to wipe them down because he didn't want to touch them to let the germs die.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's fantastic. I think mine is more about the guy I saw on the Hudson River Park on a beautiful day in the maybe late spring, and he's got two masks on, and he's sort of all bundled up, and he's walking, and he's talking out loudly on his phone, mm-hmm. and he's saying, "There are a lot of people here who are only wearing one mask." Oh, wow. He's also obviously not wearing any at all because we're outside, you idiot.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, I mean, a lot of people will probably, you know, put this memory hole in so that, like, you know, I get it. You know, some people went a little crazy. The guy put his stuff in the garage probably feels silly. Yeah. One would hope.
The problem is the people that don't feel silly. You know, by the way, Cheers was prescient.
By the way, I hope there was no ice cream in there.
Yeah.
Cheers was prescient on this. One of my favorite opens to Cheers before the theme song was when a guy's sitting at the bar and talking to, I think it's talking to Sam.
Oh, yeah.
And he's talking about how he just, you know, got done with a series of lab tests where people were experimenting, lab techs were experimenting on him and so on and so forth. He's telling this to Sam and he's listening. Then he puts down his beer and leaves. And then they go like full hazmat cleanup of the bar and the glass and the plastic bag and the Lysol everywhere and so on and so forth. You know, foreshadowing of what was to come in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of all went a little crazy. It's kind of nice to know that we can all do something together. People always say, like, you know, society is so fractured. No one does the same thing at any time. You know, we all used to watch TV, 50 million people watching the same show. It's kind of nice to know that we could all have a neurotic nervous breakdown for a year and a half together.
Yeah, it's
just that we all came out of it at different times. I mean, we were all watching a different movie. Some of us are watching the temporary movie, and some are watching the movie that goes on forever and ever and ever with 9 different sequels.
I know you're not a practicing epidemiologist, but in an area you do have expertise is on television production. And so I wanted to get your reviews of the former ABC News director's production of the season opener for the Jan 6 commission.
Oh, yeah, right. That's season opener. This is just series one. This episode, you know, the season one. This thing's going to be Game of Thrones. Unfortunately, I think for them, the Red Wedding is going to be midterm elections. But there's two functions to this thing, really, right? There's the political function, and then there's the historic function, right? Like Congress's job, right? So on the historic function, I'm not sure it really worked. I mean, I'm not going to argue whether they needed to have one or not. I mean, I think to me that what they wanted was a record of stuff that happened. And I'm not a fan. I'm certainly not a fan of Donald Trump starting election day 2020 to January 6th, 2021. I don't think he was really crossed the line. But I think all of this should have been had more impact historically if they had summed it up in a report, in something that you could write and that people would buy it. I mean, people forget, like, people bought the Star report on Bill Clinton.
Right.
That was actually a much more powerful document than hearings would have been. So I think it's on a historical level, I think it failed. On a political level, I mean, look, I mean, God love them. I mean, what else are they going to do? I mean, if you're a Democrat in America today, what other arrow do you have in your quiver? It's going to be January 6th all, you know, that's the only song they're going to sing between now and November because that's all they got.
Well, the problem, though, is that
it's not like they can tout accomplishments, you know, it's not like they can say, well, look, we did this, this, and this, and this.
Right, but the problem, But the problem is, too, is, I mean, they should do a table read with the script here, because they're not singing. They're not reading from the same script. Just this week, you had Benny Thompson, who's the chair of this Star Chamber proceeding, say there's not going to be a criminal referral. That's not our job. After, by the way, months ago, he was open to the idea of a criminal referral. And then Liz Cheney saying, well, we're not sure whether there's going to be a criminal referral yet. That'll be to be determined. So you even have members of the commission that are ostensibly on the same side. I mean, there's certainly no disagreement, but they can't figure out whether they want to press for criminal charges to the Department of Justice against Trump or not.
Well, I mean, that's exactly, I mean, that, as you said, that's the show business question, right? Because it's kind of not working. I mean, they got 20 million people to watch the first day, which was pretty good. I was surprised. I didn't expect to be that much. And the first day, maybe the first 24 hours of the hearing, sort of, you know, the hearing umbrella that we're all under, that seemed like they had planned it out. They had an argument and they had a story they were telling. But the problem with all the stuff is, like, it's like a, you know, when you're a TV show, it's like you want to get people in intent as soon as possible. So you want to get people to love it as soon as possible. But, you know, they do these studies. People who love television shows, if you talk to somebody, what's your favorite show? And they'll name it. And then I've seen every episode, they'll say. And then if you quiz them on episodes, it turns out they've only seen about a third to one half of the episode. Just because people have lives, you know, they miss stuff. They think they watched it, they wanted to watch it, but they didn't have time for it. So even your most ardent fans are still not locked in because people have other things going on in their lives.
I've seen every episode of Cheers three times. Go ahead, test me.
Oh yeah, try.
I don't have a life.
I definitely believe that because of course that's the exception to every show there is.
Oh, test them, please. Right. I want to see Dan make a mistake.
And you know what? I would be making a mistake because they all run together in my head. I think I had an argument with somebody in a bar about an episode, and they were like, no. And they just assumed that I was lying, that I didn't work on the show ever because I was wrong about a bunch of episodes. They're like, did that happen in this one? It's like it's all a jumble in my head.
See, that's, you know, the thing. It could be like this SNL skit with Shatner talking at a Trekkie convention. I'm, you know, Cheers is my Star Trek.
Yeah.
So if you get anything wrong, I'm going to be aghast.
Yeah, exactly right. You mean to tell me you're not really Captain Kirk? Exactly. But I'd say, like, so I think for the super fans, I think the super fans love the hearings. I think that the hate watchers loved watching the hating it. But that is not the goal here. The goal is to get people who have lives to focus on a couple big things. And I think in that respect, I think it failed. I'm like, I just don't think that did anybody put down their coffee cup and say, you know what, I've really rethought this, and it turns out I think Trump did some bad stuff. Nobody says that, and so in terms of fan service, it might be successful, but that was not the brief here, and so I kind of don't know why they did it, except that I feel like they're desperate, and they can't talk about things like inflation, gas prices, and the American economy, and COVID. So, you know,
he is Rob Long, former writer, producer for Cheers, co-founder of Ricochet, ricochet.com, as well as host of the Martini Shot podcast. Rob, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, we hope to have you back soon. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. As I mentioned before, Mike Scott's newscast, intrigued by this column over at spectatorworld.com by Teresa Moll. Mowing the lawn is underrated. You know, that's always what I've heard from my landscapers.
Oh,
but
we used
I can't say that I've had personal experience.
Okay, when you were growing up as a kid, please tell me you mowed your lawn and you shoveled the driveway.
Excuse me,
yeah,
that was what my sister was for.
Oh, yes, such a
Teresa Moll joins us now. Teresa, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and, you know, your point, your love affair with mowing the lawn speaks to my position, which is that that's woman's work, right?
Well, I am a woman, and I will gladly mow your lawn for you. If you'd like. But I do think that you should give it a chance, you know. As I write in my column, it's a really great way to relax. And unlike watching the TV or something that kind of, you know, you're relaxing, but you feel kind of lazy, maybe a little guilty sitting there on the couch. I say that mowing the lawn is a form of active leisure. So you're getting a job done, you're doing a chore, but it's really enjoyable. This is, I must say, with a riding mower. I do like a push mower now and then too. You know, it's a good way to get a workout and sweat while also keeping care of business. But
you feel like you're accomplishing something because, you know, you see it's
exactly
high up, and then you could set the mower to whatever height you want, and then you finish it, and you've got this sense of accomplishment.
You get it. Maybe it's a woman thing, you know. We appreciate the little things. And it's also a gift for everyone else who experiences this fresh cut lawn and the smell of it and everything. Yeah, it's great. You really need to give it a shot.
No, I mean, I understand that, you know, men as well, you know, pride themselves on their lawn. Clint Eastwood and Gran Torino made that point clear. But you know, you talk about going to your ancestral home in rural Pennsylvania. So give us some flavor here of why it's so important. And it also, you know, connects back to your childhood, of course.
Yeah. So I grew up on a piece of property here in rural central Pennsylvania that my ancestors acquired around the time of the Civil War. So I'm very blessed to have a really deep connection and deep roots here in central PA, and I have the honor, I think it's a privilege, to still have that property in our family and to be able to reconnect with it through mowing the lawn. You know, we have about 7 acres that I mow there, and I do it a little bit differently every time. You know, I'll start on one section and go to a different one, and every time I feel like I notice something different, you know, a new tree or a plot of flowers that I think maybe my ancestors would have planted back in the day. And as I do this, I like to imagine what they would have been like, you know, what they did 100, 150 years ago, if they were had picnics here, what they talked about, you know, just what their personalities might have been like. And it's a really neat opportunity that I like to combine with mowing the lawn, you know, getting a chore done, but also reconnecting with my past.
When I see trees, I think, oh, God, I need to practice my punch shots, you know, because I just put everything through the prism of golf. And, so, you know, trees are a bit of a nuisance for me, and then I got to practice different shots. And so I see them as a hazard more than as, as a gift from God, I guess.
Well, it's all about perspective, you know.
Yeah,
maybe not a hazard so much as a challenge, you know.
Challenge.
How boring would golf be if you just had a straight, flat line every time, you know? It would be easy, too easy, and we need a little challenge in life to make us better.
Sure. Gosh, it's like I'm talking to Seth Rayner. Okay, very good. Well, speaking of your rural Pennsylvania roots, you also penned a piece about guns and this bipartisan congregation of senators that are going to do something, apparently, quote unquote, on guns.
Right. So these 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans, so-called Republicans, quote unquote, I will say, just came out with this proposed gun bill. It's being hailed as this great bipartisan agreement on gun violence. And that's something that I write that we have to be careful with. The language gun violence makes it sound as if the gun is a thing that's being violent. The same thing with gun safety, as if a gun is inherently violent or safe, which of course we know is not the case. So that's my first issue among many with this bill. So we're not really sure what it's going to do or proposes to do specifically. The language is pretty alarmingly vague. We do know that it's just more of the same gun control laws aimed at law-abiding citizens, because of course we know the law-abiding are the only people who are going to, you know, the only people that gun control affects. It does nothing to criminals. You guys know that in Chicago more than anybody. but the scariest part of this proposed bill is the red flag gun confiscation proposal. This basically turns due process on its head. In some cases, some states already have these laws on the books, and it enables pretty much anyone. You could have a vindictive ex, a neighbor who's mad at you. They can report you to the police. The police can show up based on a tip and determine that you are unfit to have guns, take your guns away from you, and then it's up to you to spend your own money on legal fees. Months and months, you will go without having your weapons, without being able to defend yourself, and you have to prove yourself innocent. So that's something really scary, and luckily we have several Republicans who are sounding the alarm on the red flag laws and are vowing not to let this legislation through. So we will see. We just have to remain vigilant.
What about the boyfriend loophole law? Because isn't it already, if you're charged with domestic violence, you can't purchase a weapon? Or is each state
exactly
different?
That's something that's another, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's another thing that this law says. It'll make it harder for, or it'll make it so that criminals can't get guns, but we know that that's already illegal. That's another thing they like to say about the ghost gun, the bans on so-called ghost guns. It says that it'll make it so that criminals can't access guns, but that's already a law, and it kind of proves the point that gun control doesn't work, because they're saying like, oh, well, this first gun control bill doesn't work, so let's add another one because criminals are still getting guns, which, of course, we know criminals don't care about the gun laws. So, of course, they're going to get guns, and they do. And, it's just more of the same. They just want to show that they're doing something in reaction to these school shootings, and it's not going to be effective, but at least they can say they tried.
I mean, it's just sort of interesting how the left has any pretense of being civil libertarians, like so many of them like to claim they are, because the concern here is not keeping. I have no concern about keeping guns out of the hands of people convicted of domestic violence or other crimes. Nobody's opposed to that. But we do want due process. We do want to make sure red flag laws are adversarial so that the person who is being red flagged has the chance to make their case. And again, you don't, as you were sort of describing, we don't turn our justice system on the head where you have to prove you're innocent rather than the charging party prove that you're a public threat. And that seems to be the rub. And it's it's a bit lost in the idea we're going to do something, red flag laws, boyfriend loophole, and it's never explained. And there's not questions to provide details for the American public to consume. It's just we're doing something. We're closing loopholes. We're red flagging people who may be a threat, and so on and so forth. The way that you do those things turns out to be important if you believe in people's individual rights.
Right, exactly, and it all sounds good on paper. You know, of course, we all want to stop people who are dangerous and a threat from having dangerous weapons, but like we said, we already have gun control on the books, and the places that we actually have the most gun control, Chicago, Baltimore, Los Angeles, those are some of the most dangerous places in America, some of the most violent. So instead of adding more gun control and putting the government in charge of determining who's dangerous and who's not dangerous, I frankly don't trust the government to be able to determine that. We should fix some of the gun control we already have on the books, and to make it effective. We already have background checks, and 93% of the time, whenever they deny somebody a weapon, they get it wrong. That's something that we don't talk about. It's like, oh, well, we have gun control, but it's not working, and why? Instead of fixing it, they just want to throw, it's kind of like throwing more money at the problem rather than going to the root cause of what's causing this violence and the failed laws we already have enacted. Instead of fixing those, they just want to put more and more and more.
All right. On the lawn matter, just got a text. Chris, the great Chris Isaac, baby did a bad, bad thing. I don't want to fall in love. That Chris Isaac was once asked.
I love Chris this Isaac. Is from,
no, he's the best. He's the best. I saw him at the Area Crown, one of the greatest shows I've ever seen, when he wore that mirror suit that he used to wear. Chris Isaac was once asked what it's like to write a song. He said, you know what it's like when you finish cutting the lawn and you see all the straight rows of nicely cut grass? That's the closest thing I can compare it to that most people know. Mowing the lawn is like writing a song.
Go.
It's positively artistic. Wow.
I don't know when the last time you mowed the lawn was, but I feel like we're kind of convincing you here. Chris Isaac agrees with me. I mean, come on.
Yeah, no, I think that the weight of your opinion with Chris Isaacs, I think I'm persuaded. I didn't realize the artistry involved. Yeah, it's transcendental is what I'm hearing. All right, very good. She is Teresa Mall. She's a columnist for Spectator World. Teresa, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and good luck with that lawn.
Thank you.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.